You are listening to Ukraine 242. We bring you interview subjects from all walks of life in wartime in Ukraine. Thanks to all our listeners around the world.
Welcome to Ukraine 242, a weekly program that features interviews with experts and key people on the ground in Ukraine and around the world, responding to events and issues since the Russian invasion. I'm your host for this week, Ursula Rudenberg. Today, the second part of a conversation with two journalists, Alia Chandra and Bodan Ben, from Euromaidan Press, an online English-language independent newspaper based in Ukraine. Alia and Bodan both participated in the Euromaidan protests, otherwise known as the Revolution of Dignity, grassroots people's rebellion in 2014 that solidified Ukraine's pivot away from Russia towards Western Europe. Euromaidan, with its preceding Orange Revolution, is one of the most successful grassroots popular rebellions in modern times. As a result, in 2014, the then president of Ukraine fled the country, leading to the formation of the government we know today. Last week, in the first half of our conversation, Alia Chandra and Bodan Ben described the political situation and events leading up to Euromaidan. They described the 2004 Orange Revolution, a mass uprising that stopped a presidential election from being stolen, and then the beginning of Euromaidan protests in 2013, when Viktor Yanukovych, Ukraine's Moscow-leaning president, made a surprise deal with Russia that went back on an election promise to sign an agreement with the European Union. Protests began at the city square in Kyiv, called Maidan, with college students, and then spread to other cities. Alia described how the Maidan Square was occupied in Kyiv, along with government buildings. Bodan, who was in school in Lviv, described how he and others made speeches in their own town square and blocked the police to prevent them from mobilizing to dissipate protesters. Alia and Bodan frame the meaning of the Euromaidan Revolution of Dignity as the pivotal moment for Ukrainian society in two important irreversible ways. It's when the country turned away from Russia towards what they perceive as Western democracy. It's also when participatory citizenship became cemented into their culture, enabling Ukrainians to fight their current war. Alia said,
I very much remember this feeling that something is not right in Ukraine, and this feeling of living a not dignified life the way that it should be, that our rulers are corrupt, there's a lot of wrong things in society. This feeling was in Ukraine all the time after the Soviet Union. And of course, there was this yearning for it to be made right. But the problem was that we had this idea that somehow a savior would come and build this normal country for us. But the awareness is growing and growing that there will be no savior figure. Nobody can save Ukraine. Democracy is built when a critical mass of people take part in it, participate in democracy, and make sure that we are building this country of our dream together.
According to both Alia and Bodan, the revolution was sparked when violence was used against the Euromaidan protesters.
People wanted something to be happening. And at one point, they just said, well, if you are not going to give any plans, then we're just going to go and block parliament right now. The parliament was located a few blocks away. And on their way, they were met by the riot police that stood like a wall. And the first violence emerged. And from that day on, Maidan, I think, really asserted its decisiveness, that it's not going to back down. Because we saw protests in Belarus when Lukashenko again won the election, but of course it was rigged. And the whole world praised the peacefulness of the protests, but they did not bring about any change. They were just dispersed. And now just tens of thousands of activists, they're just being sentenced away to dozens of years in jail. Sometimes if you're protest is only peaceful and you're not willing to die for your ideals, then you will just be squashed. Maidan could have gone the same way, but it didn't, because protesters were ready to stand up. And some protesters on Euromaidan, they were willing to die for their ideals. And this is why it succeeded.
Was the decision to stand up to that violence a spontaneous decision, or was there a discussion about whether people were going to go that far? Or was this just kind of something that was understood?
It was something that was understood. Of course, the people that were not ready to put themselves into danger, they did not stay there. But I remember there was a series of nights where the riot police would try to break up Maidan in the night. So basically, it was like this, the night offensive of the riot police. And it depended on the hundreds of people that did still stand in the square, whether the Maidan movement will be stomped out or not. And I see it no other than a miracle that we were actually able to withstand the sea of police. I still don't know how it was possible. But in the end, there was this feeling that this is the ultimate battle between good and evil. That if we let this fight for good down, that I don't know what's going to happen next to our country. It was this feeling that we just cannot back down, because otherwise we're falling off a precipice. Of course, we knew that the government was hunting down the activists. There were a lot of initiatives, like self-help initiatives, that developed at that time. For instance, a coalition that would help find activists who were taken to hospitals because protesters were beaten up and they got admitted into a hospital. But the hospital said they would give them away to the police, and the government would then either kill the activists or lock them up. So teams emerged that would rescue these activists from the hospitals, and then field hospital emerged in Maidan to treat the protesters that were beaten. You know, it was just so many initiatives. The ecosystem of Maidan, it's a separate topic. It was just so many very creative initiatives that emerged, united under this big, big goal to protect the good, to stand up for the good.
Can you describe that ecosystem a little?
There was a University of Maidan where lectures were being held and Ukrainians just discussed of how their country should change.
The University of Maidan, where was that happening?
It was happening in different locations. It was inside a big tent on the street. Then it was inside a building that the protesters occupied.
Presumably, you had a lot of people coming to Kyiv for the protests from other locations. Where did they stay?
Well, first of all, there were tents that they could live in. And they could live in the buildings that the protesters occupied. So basically, there were just like stacks of sleeping bags. People were just sleeping on the floor side by side. And there was an initiative to host your Maidan protesters from other cities in your flats.
And how did people eat? I mean, was there food brought in, or were restaurants doing takeout? Or I mean, how did
it was a combination of everything. There were a lot of field kitchens. There were a lot of charities that were cooking food. There was this guy from a borscht festival that was cooking, like, I don't know, a ton of borscht every day. And borscht is this very traditional Ukrainian beet soup. And there were farmers that would donate their produce for Maidan. And then there was like people who volunteered to make sandwiches, and these were just carried out all around the square. So, you know, it was really a very, very grassroots sort of thing.
Did you have porta potties, or how? I'm sorry, but these little details is what can kill a situation, right? When people can't manage.
Yes, there were porta potties, and of course there were the toilets in the government buildings that were occupied. And so this is like very centralized protest in the center of a city, and the protesters just took over several large administrative buildings in the center of the city, and so the toilets were widely used there.
How often were you at the square?
At first, I was trying to go every day, and my problem was at first that I couldn't find a task for myself, so I didn't just want to wander around. And first, I found myself a sandwich-making job in the kitchen, and I was making sandwiches for hours, and I soon grew tired of that, and I was looking for some other job, and I saw this call for translators, and this is how I actually ended up where I work right now. Euromaidan Press, media that my colleague Bogdan, I, and a lot of other good colleagues from Ukraine work in. It tells about Ukraine. So basically, we emerged during the Euromaidan Revolution to tell the story of Euromaidan to Western audiences, because the Russian disinformation was just flooding the media. And of course, saying that Maidan was run by the far right, that there were some Nazis there. And, you know, like this very myth of the Ukrainian far right, it emerged by Russian propagandists at that time. And unfortunately, it's a myth that does not go away. So to counter all sorts of this disinformation, both from Russia and from our own authorities, we decided to launch these information movements. And this is where we continue working to this day. My hope was then that this revolution, maybe it will end and I will have a break, but it never ended, because As soon as Euromaidan won, Russia invaded Crimea, it invaded Donbass and started a war. And here we are 10 years later.
Yeah. How did you actually go about collecting information and getting it out during the demonstrations?
Of course, we were there on the site. Basically, we just saw what was happening real time being there on Maidan. So we interviewed people. We were reporting real time, basically what was happening on the square in various languages.
And did people use it as an information source?
Yes, of course. It was one of the most cited information Twitter accounts during the Euromaidan revolution.
And Bogdan, did you end up going to Kyiv or did things just develop in Lviv?
No, my father went to Kyiv, but I wasn't allowed. And I was protesting in Lviv. We were blocking police officers and holding this main stage on the main square of the city. And there was a free microphone, so basically everyone could just apply and go to the stage and say what they think for 3 minutes.
Did the demonstration in Lviv grow or dwindle?
I would say no less than a few hundred people were every day. There could be maybe 5,000-10,000 people in the main square of the city. Mm. It was much more peaceful because actually police officers themselves didn't want to disperse Maidan. It was more violent in Kyiv.
I remember this feeling, like this battle between good and evil happening right here, this place, and you cannot back down.
When it reached that point of a life and death situation, were there certain people who came forward and said, we're the soldiers, we're going to put our lives on the line?
There was a soldier group, yes. It was the self-defense of Maidan who acted as this barrier between the police and the Maidan camp. And they just made wooden shields for themselves. And of course, later on, they found metal shields and were better equipped. They had helmets, like ski helmets. They had maybe some ski padding and they were armed with wooden sticks. It was really this sort of ragtag army. I later found out that many people who were working in security services before, but were sympathetic to the protesters, they joined the movement and organized like the security of Maidan. So basically, it was like this army of ragtag self-defense volunteers who were schooled by more experienced professionals. And they were the ones that were holding the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did these people begin to arm themselves?
There were reports of people carrying firearms later on when the snipers started shooting.
Did anybody ever shoot back?
I'm not aware of that, but I'm sure that there were plans after these snipers started shooting.
A little more than 100 protesters were killed, some by snipers, and approximately 2,500 were injured.
There were these sporadic deaths that happened from the very start of the Maidan. So protesters, they were kidnapped, they were beaten up, and this was the cause of death of some protesters. But real massive killings, they happened on February on Institutska Street. This is when governments and snipers, they shot around 50 people in 2 days. After that, of course, nobody wanted any compromises with Yanukovych.
When that happened, there was not the sense of retreat.
No.
Too much momentum, right?
Yes, of course.
So instead of retreating, it caused people to commit.
Yes, of course. But basically, some Western politicians came and brokered a deal between our opposition and Yanukovych. And, you know, this wasn't received well by the protesters. They were saying that after the first killings happened on Maidan, after the snipers killed protesters, that was the point of no return. And the Euromaidaners, they wanted Yanukovych to go on trial. And, you know, it was this feeling of desperation, basically, as Bogdan and his friends were blocking these police from going to disperse Maidan. And Maidan, there was this guy, Parasyuk, that came onto the stage and said that we don't accept any compromises. If Yanukovych does not go away, then I'm saying that my comrades and I have some weapons. We will go and use them. We're not going to back down. You will not intimidate us. And he said this from the stage. It was a very powerful speech.
It was the by any means necessary speech.
Yes. We are here standing for a just reason. And if it must be, then we will die on the square defending our ideals. It was that strong. It was that powerful. And it was a feeling shared by all of these protesters that were on the square. And the next day, Yanukovych fled.
You think it was a response to that speech?
I don't know what it was, but, you know, it was like this Parasyuk, Volodymyr Parasyuk, he expressed things that people were feeling and that we cannot take up any compromises with this killer. He has to go away. We don't know what will happen, but he just must go away. He cannot be our president anymore. I was there. They felt like, oh, yes, of course we can't back down. And the next day, Yanukovych fled.
Did anybody think that Yanukovych would flee the country? I mean, was that a goal that anybody had considered?
No, we did not know what would happen. Nobody was thinking that he could flee.
In the Western Ukraine, people completely occupied all the security service and police offices and regional administration. So there was no more Yanukovych power in the West. And in Central Ukraine, some regional administrations were occupied. So his power was starting to collapse. And he had just to choose what to do. And he chose to flee. Why? Of course, we don't know. But that was his choice.
So when you heard that Yanukovych had taken off, what did you think? Were you surprised?
I was personally very much surprised.
How did you find out?
Just news. It spread in the morning. We were going for the streets and it was amazing. These big military trucks driving around, but with our guys on top, with the self-defense. It was an exhilarating feeling.
When Yanukovych left, I mean, how does that work? One day the police are working to repress you and the next minute they don't?
It doesn't mean that the police were supporting Yanukovych. So basically, Yanukovych had to order police units from Crimea to come to Kyiv to disperse Maidan.
But we also have to understand that, you know, the vertical of power collapsed. So like the police chief, he got his orders from Yanukovych. And if Yanukovych is gone, I think the police chief also fled.
All of a sudden, there was just no police in Maidan?
Yes. All of a sudden, they stopped getting their orders to go out. And basically, an interim government emerged. So there was a vote in parliament to appoint interim leaders. And these leaders took over. And these leaders were from the opposition politicians. So Yanukovych was gone, parliament voted for interim government, and the new chapter of Ukraine began. It was a feeling of victory. It was an amazing feeling, but it lasted only a day because the occupation of Crimea started and then the war.
Yeah. Earlier in our conversation, you described the self-defense of Maidan protesters who emerged to protect the rest of the protesters from the police. Was this the origin of the volunteer fighters that headed east when Russia began to occupy the Donbas?
I think yes. I'm sure that many of them did. I'm sure that this willingness to defend your country and this feeling that everything is on the line, that this is really is a battle between good and evil and we must not stand aside, that this feeling motivated them to take up arms later on and defend their country. But, you know, this motivation wasn't only for the people who took up arms. It was for the activists on Maidan who wanted to change their country for the better. Just a huge plethora of activist group was born for Maidan because Ukrainians suddenly understood that they have to take the future of their country into their own hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like there is really a myriad of NGOs, a myriad of civic groups that started from the Euromaidan revolution and that are working to this day to change their country. My friend who was participating in a human rights movement called Euromaidan SOS to locate people who disappeared, who were kidnapped by the government during protests. They were part of the first human rights groups that went to Crimea to document what was happening, how the Russian soldiers in disguise were going to be kidnapping the pro-Ukrainian activists. And basically, they were documenting this takeover of peninsula.
There was a package of reforms, and I participated in my internship a little bit. So these were hundreds of activists who self-organized working groups, and they elaborated what reforms should be complete. And later, they just submitted all those plans to the new government, and government basically took it and supported with few changes. So this is how most of Ukrainian reforms were done in 2014, 15, 16. Later, of course, it didn't play a huge role. But in the beginning, just this activist brought plans to the new government. It just accepted it.
Wow, this is so fascinating. So then you had newly elected president. Was there anybody before Poroshenko? Was he the first one?
Turchenko. He was elected by parliament, an acting president before elections were held for 3 months. And after that, Poroshenko was elected.
And after Poroshenko was Zelensky. One thing I was curious about at the beginning of this interview, you were talking about how there's this desire for a savior to come and make everything work instead of the hard work of democracy. When Zelensky kind of came out of nowhere as president, was that what brought him in like that? Was there a feeling that this guy was going to make things work? Or what brought Zelensky in like that?
It was a combination of factors. I will maybe mention a few and Bogdan can continue. Well, there was, of course, this desire for a savior and also the populism of Zelensky. There was this TV show and basically the propaganda boost that he got from a major TV channel. There was also like this disinformation campaign against Poroshenko, I would say, that was very successful. But Poroshenko was not perfect. There were a lot of criticism towards him from activists also. So it was complicated. Bogdan, maybe you can elaborate.
It was not about voting for Zelensky, but more just voting for someone else, not Poroshenko. Because Poroshenko didn't implement the reforms that were expected by protesters in the beginning. For example, an anti-corruption reform, transparency reform, judiciary reforms, there is a long list. And this was the criticism for Poroshenko. Why haven't you managed for 5 years to do all these reforms? And Zelensky successfully played on this.
So is there a sense now that Zelensky is doing what you had hoped? Or is he like Poroshenko now, where he's not making things happen as quickly as you'd like? Or does the fact of this full-scale invasion just change everything so much that it's hard to sort out?
The invasion changed lots of things. Before the war, there was quite a lot of criticism towards Zelensky, although still he had quite high support. And of course, after the war started, politics were put aside and people just fought. And now, after 2 years of war, when we have some time to reflect and need to adapt our long-term strategy, we have some criticism again, for example, about preparation for war, that Zelensky didn't prepare the country well enough.
The war really has changed Zelensky. If he entered politics maybe with this naivety towards Russia, one of his pre-electoral promises was that he will end the conflict in Donbass. He will just have a call with Putin or a meeting with Putin and settle it all. And, you know, the nationally minded Ukrainians had an aversion to Zelensky because they felt that he was not taking the national idea and the national project seriously enough, and he does not recognize Russia as a mortal danger. But of course, after 2 years of war with Russia, Zelensky has changed a lot. And if you can even compare his photographs before the war and after the war, these are two different men. I think that he understands a lot better generations of Ukrainians that died pursuing the dream to have an independent state. He now understands what it's all about. But right now, of course, I mean, reforms are really important, but all Ukrainians understand that it's a matter of survival. It's a matter of national survival right now. If we don't win this war, then, I mean, we can say goodbye. The only number one goal is victory in this war.
There's a whole lot to absorb here. It's very hard to comprehend the transition from the ideals of the Euromaidan demonstrations and this clear drive towards a democratic state, and then the transition from that to basic survival. I don't know what you do with that in your head. It's such a huge and quick progression of realities. How do you make sense of it?
I appreciate that this is something that's very hard for people that are living in developed democracies to comprehend. People who have not had to fight for their national survival, who don't even think about what a nation is. Maybe take it lightheartedly. Maybe they don't think that having a nation is important and they don't understand what these Ukrainians are protesting about. Why is it so important for them to be separate from Russia? But, you know, that's because you have been living in this Western developed democracy. It really is the best thing that we have right now. It creates the best conditions for human life. And reaching this stage of society is so important for Ukrainians that they are dying for it right now. It's really hard to understand when you take it for granted. I mean, you don't notice the air that you breathe. You're living in a developed democracy. You don't notice how blessed you are with all the goods that it gives you. Here, we're willing to die for that. And we're fighting to be able to live in a state of dignity. And it is hard to convey to somebody who is not in this situation. So thank you so much for speaking to us about it.
It's quite hard to explain for people who live in peaceful countries. But still, now I value very much the Ukraine of 2020 before the war. Despite all imperfections, still it was a democracy and a liberal free state. And now all this is endangered by invasion. I understand that if we lose, Russians will just go and kill me because I wrote some articles for Euromaidan, for example. And I understand that all my family would have to flee the country and basically everything will be lost. So nothing will be left. So we don't have any other choice but to win or death. This is the question of survival.
How do you stay calm about it?
Interesting question. I don't know. Humans can somehow adapt to such things. Probably people get used to everything. But still, it's not normal. Because you can't plan, for example, your future. You just live day by day doing your work, but you can't plan for what they would like to do. So it's like this half life.
Yeah. Do you still feel that if Ukraine does survive, that it will be a step towards the things that you fought for it at Maidan? Feel
of course. No, of course. It will be a realization of this goal. And of course, it depends on us how our country will go after it, because post-war stage of any country is not easy. The country has been terribly destroyed. It has suffered so much death, so much destruction, and it will continue to suffer. It has just thrown us back in development. It has killed so many. How many people have lost their limbs? How many have become disabled from this war? How many people have emigrated? I mean, but of course, we deserve to exist. We deserve to live. And this is what we're fighting for. We deserve to live as a separate Ukrainian nation. And that's what we're fighting for.
And do you think there is a transition to people taking responsibility for that in, as a collective, instead of expecting a leader to make this all happen for you? Or I guess what I'm asking is, has collective democracy matured through the war?
Definitely. Definitely. It's happening. This development of society that started in Maidan and even before, I mean, it's something that continues.
I believe history doesn't repeat itself the same way. For example, we had also Ukrainian Revolution in 1917 when we had our state, but for a brief period, and it was occupied by Soviet Union and repressions followed. And I believe that this time it should be different.
You've really grown up with this your whole life.
Ideal. Yes, I was born in 1997, so I believe this post-Soviet poor years. And then I lived through Yushchenko presidency when, for example, my parents built their house and then people could finally live normally. But then I remember Euromaidan revolution reforms, where I also participated. And then the war, when all this is now endangered and partially destroyed. I hope after all the revolutions and 10 years before, Ukraine should finally succeed as a democratic state and as a free state with self-determination, with both individual and national dignity.
It's just incredible to hear what you're going through. So. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate your interview.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And this has been Ukraine 242. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, here with two journalists, Alia Chandra and Bohdan Ben, from the Euromaidan Press, an online English-language independent newspaper based in Ukraine. Bohdan Ben is a researcher in the field of social and economic philosophy and local governance. Alia Chandra is the editor-in-chief of Euromaidan Press. More information about Euromaidan Press or to see their work, go to euromaidanpress.com. That's euromaidanpress.com. Until next week, thank you for listening to Ukraine 242.